Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
And welcome to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Today, when good people commit horrifying acts, the hidden capacity in each and every one of us, you too, to conform, to abuse power, and to harm others in appalling ways.
You shut up. Who are you anyway, just sitting there telling people what to do? You can't hunt, you can't sing.
I'm chief. I was chosen.
Why should choosing make any difference?
The rules, you're breaking the rules.
Who cares?
Because the rules are the only thing we got.
Bollocks to the rules. We're strong, we hunt. So the beast will hunt it down and beat and beat.
The chaos that unfolded for the children in William Golding's dark tale, Lord of the Flies. Stranded on an island, innocence turns to terror.
Wouldn't it be better to be a pack of friendly savages like you?
Any of us could be seduced across that line from good and evil. Most people are good people most of the time, and we'd like to believe that we always are and we never could cross that line. What my research with the Stanford Prison Study and my investigative reporting of Abu Ghraib and other situations I've been in, I studied tortures in Brazil firsthand, leads me to conclude that most people under specified conditions where there's dehumanization at work, anonymity, diffusion of responsibility, can be drawn across that line and do things they could never imagine themselves usually doing. So big question is, how well do you know yourself? How well do you know, how certain can you be when you say, I would never do that? I would, if I were a guard in a prison like Abu Ghraib, I would never abuse prisons. I would never do those terrible things.
The man behind one of history's most notorious psychological experiments, Professor Emeritus Philip Zimbardo from Stanford University, is my guest today. And he says the Stanford Prison Experiment of 1971 must never be repeated.
Well, 30 years ago, an American scientist conducted one of the most notorious experiments. Within 6 days, the guards had become so brutal, the prisoners started showing signs of mental disturbance, and the study had to be stopped.
This is where it all happened in the summer of 1971. Right down this corridor in the basement of the psychology department is where we converted these offices and storage rooms to prison cells. And we had students like yourself, college students from all over the country, play the roles of either prisoners or guards. Here in this closet was solitary confinement, the infamous hole where the guards
right
put prisoners to punish.
Have a seat, have a seat, have a seat.
You want to step right in here, man?
Have a seat, have a seat, have a seat.
A huge figure in psychology and former president of the American Psychological Association, Philip Zimbardo's new book is called The Lucifer Effect: How Good People Turn Evil. And recently he was an expert witness in the case of one of the US soldiers convicted of committing atrocities in the Abu Ghraib scandal.
It's great to be here with you, Natasha.
Look, Lucifer was God's favourite angel. Tell me about the title of your new book, The Lucifer Effect.
Well, I've always been fascinated with that story or myth that the angel who was apparently God's favorite, and we don't know why, what made him the favorite, one day was cast out of heaven and put into hell. Paradoxically, it was God who created hell. And the reason he was cast out along with some other angels is that when God made Adam, he wanted all the angels to honor him as his perfect creature. And Lucifer and some of the other angels refused because they said, we were prior to Lucifer and we are angels and he is a mere mortal. Well, that was two sins in one, pride and disobedience. And apparently it was a God who was unforgiving, so instead of sending him to a different cloud, he sent him to hell. And the reason I call my book The Lucifer Effect is that, in a sense, that is the most extreme transformation of good into evil that's imaginable. That God's favorite angel, not just any angel, becomes the devil, not just any bad guy. And so, in a way, it sets the context for the research I've been doing and my colleagues have been doing, which investigates how ordinary people, not angels, first begin to cross that line between good and evil. Most people, under certain circumstances, can be seduced, initiated, recruited into doing bad things. And by bad things, I don't necessarily mean end-of-the-line torture, but evil starts often with teasing and bullying and cheating and lying and spreading rumors and ruining someone's reputation.
Let's head back to the Stanford prison experiment of 1971 and the chilling situation, Phil, that you yourself generated in the corridors of your own university. Set the scene.
At that time, I was interested in the basic question, what happens when you put good people in a bad place? Does the goodness of people, does humanity win over the qualities of a prison-like environment? And we know throughout the world, prisons are places that breed contempt, hostility, aggression, violence, almost all the worst aspects of human nature. However bad people are when they go into the prison, they almost always come out, at least many of them do, worse. And so we created a mock prison because we wanted to be able to control the kinds of young men who went in as prisoners and guards. We wanted to be sure there was no pre-existing difference between the boys who are going to be selected to be guards or prisoners.
Here's one of the rooms that was a cell. Here's a box with old memorabilia from our study. This is one of the prisoner's uniform, prisoner 819. You can see it's really a dress. Here are the chains that the guards made the prisoners wear.
It was a simulation that was really planned down to the last detail, wasn't it? I mean, the city police did the arrests for you. You had a recent ex-inmate as the head of your phony parole board.
You might say I'm a drama queen, or I should have been a movie director rather than a psychologist. But I try to make it very realistic. We had a Catholic prison chaplain come down to interview and counsel the boys. We had an ex-convict head of the parole board. We had visitors nights with parents and girlfriends and boyfriends, a public defender.
The experiment now has cult status, of course, in undergraduate psychology curricula. What, in a matter of days, what terrible things transpired?
The worst thing that happens to guards in a prison is they get bored. And the guards, especially on the night shift, and this is true both at Stanford and we can talk later about Abu Ghraib, the worst abuses happen in both on the night shift. The students or the prisoners are sleeping. And the guards would wake them up and use them as their playthings to entertain them. And the entertainment got more and more extreme. The entertainment is always, with men on men, always drifts toward a sexual humiliation or sexual degradation. Lindy Englund, one of the Army Reserve women who did some of the terrible things at Abu Ghraib, she said, it was just fun and games. We didn't think anything was wrong with it. Mm. And our guards were playing games. So, for example, you'd say, you see the hole in the floor, get down and F it. Because they were bored with having the prisoners do push-ups. And then they'd say, okay, now you're Frankenstein, you're Mrs. Frankenstein. Walk like them, hug them, say you love them. The things begin to be homophobic. And then they have them do leapfrog, except the prisoners were wearing smocks with no underpants. And when they played leapfrog, their testicles would bang on each other's heads and the guards would get hysterical.
It got nasty.
It got nastier and nastier. Mm. Guards were abusing prisoners in every way they could. I was the prison superintendent. I limited physical aggression, but that opened the door for psychological abuse.
Well, interestingly, Phil, you actually started out more interested in what the prisoners were going to do, but the guards became a focus of interest, didn't they?
Yeah, well, see, it was 1971. In 1971, it was the hippie revolution, sex, drugs, rock and roll here, but also anti-war and anti-prisons. And so students and myself, we were interested in the plight of prisoners because none of us could ever imagine being prison guards. But over time, what was fascinating was how dramatically transformed the guards were. Again, these are boys we chose because they're as normal, as healthy, and they're intelligent college students as imaginable.
You describe what unfolded as an ecology of dehumanization.
Dehumanization is really maybe the most basic psychological process that pushes, propels good people to do really bad things. And in a particular situation, the humanity of other people is taken away, is deprived. You think of them as less than human, as animals. You think of them as insects. You think of them as vermin. And once inferior, then you do whatever either gives you pleasure or whatever the top-down command tells you is necessary to do. The surprising thing was how quickly and how extremely this environment got to people. And essentially, we talk about it as the power of the situation to undercut the goodness that most of these boys brought into that situation. Within 36 hours, prison 8612, I still remember his number vividly after all these years, had an emotional breakdown, screaming, uncontrollable, crying, hysterical. We had to release him. He was ringleader of the student rebellion. On the second day, he organized the rebellion of the prisoners against the guards because they didn't want to be dehumanized. They didn't want to be reduced to numbers. And because he was the ringleader, the guards then focused on him as somebody whose spirit they had to crush. And so he suddenly got personal revenge, personal sentiment of the guards to get even with the prisoners. And so by the end of the fifth day, five students had emotional breakdowns, or one young man, he developed a full body rash, and we had to release him. And so we had to end the study because it was literally out of control.
So let's hear from one of the students who became a particularly sadistic guard, Guard Hellman, in conversation with a fellow student he tormented, prisoner number 416, or Clay, the Stanford Prison Experiment, revisited.
Then you put a uniform on, saying your job is to keep these people in line. You really become that person. Once you put on that khaki uniform, you put on the glasses, you take the nightstick, and you act the part.
It still is a prison to me. I don't look on it as an experiment or a simulation. It's just a prison that was run by psychologists instead of run by the state. I began to feel that identity, that the person that I was, that had decided to go to prison, was distant from me. Until finally, I was 416. I was really my number, and 416 was going to have to decide what to do. I've read a lot about it, but I've never experienced it firsthand. I've never seen someone turn that way. And I know you're a nice guy.
You
understand?
That,
I do. I do know you're a nice guy.
Then why,
I don't get that, because I know what you can turn into. I know what you're willing to do. If you say, oh, well, I'm not going to hurt anybody. Oh, well, it's a limited situation. It's over in 2 weeks.
Well, you in position, what would you have done?
I don't know.
Perhaps one of the most disturbing things for me was that in the end the prisoners didn't go out of their way to defend each other or support each other, and nor did visitors from outside really indicate to you that they had a problem with what was going on. In fact, everyone almost became complicit in the experiment, didn't they?
Absolutely. And Natasha, you picked up something that most people know about the study miss. If I told you, imagine you're a prisoner, who would you like to have come down on your behalf? You say, well, how about a Catholic priest? How about a public defender? How about your mother? I brought all of those people down to that prison several times. The point is, what they saw is a scene that we stage, and this is true in virtually every prison when there's a congressional hearing or whether there's a prison task force comes down. So the parents then, being good middle class parents, they too fall into the conforming to the power of the situation.
Mm. And this is where your role comes into play here, because you've been apologizing in a sense for this experiment ever since.
All those years.
You played the role of the Stanford Prison's superintendent, but you were also cast necessarily as a dispassionate, objective research scientist, a conflict of interest, surely.
You hit it right on the head again. It was a huge mistake. You cannot play those two roles. That the experimenter has to be objective and essentially, in a way, above the mundane reality of what's happening, because your job is to collect data to be sure that everything is being handled as ethically as possible and as scientifically sound as possible. As a prison superintendent, your main job is maintaining the integrity of the prison.
Wouldn't pass an ethics committee today, though, would it?
Oh, wouldn't pass an ethics, but it did pass an ethics committee in those days.
Indeed. This is ABC Radio National. Natasha Mitchell with you for All in the Mind, going global on Radio Australia and as podcast. My guest today is acclaimed psychologist Philip Zimbardo, the man behind the notorious Stanford Prison Experiment in 1971, and author of the new book, The Lucifer Effect. Look, it was someone very close to you, a fellow psychologist, in fact now your wife of more than three decades, I gather, who prompted you to end it early, who in a sense woke you up to the reality of what you'd created.
Being in a situation where I helped create a hell in paradise. Stanford University is one of the most beautiful universities in the world. And in that basement in the psychology department, I created a mini hell for all those students. This young woman, Christina Maslach, just gotten a job as a psychology professor at Berkeley. And we had just started dating. I looked up and in front of my door was the usual 10 o'clock toilet run. Prisoners with paper bags over their heads, legs chained together, and one arm on each other's shoulder, marching blindly down the hall with guards yelling at them obscenely. And I looked up from whatever I was doing and I said, "Hey, Chris, look at that." So I said something like, "The crucible of human behavior." And she said, "I don't want to see any more of this." And she ran out. And I ran after her and we had a big argument. "What's wrong with you? What kind of psychologist are you?" And she says to me, "I don't want to hear about simulation. I don't want to hear about the power of the situation. Quote, it is terrible what you are doing to those boys. They're not students. They're not prisoners. They're not guards. They're young men. What's happening to them is terrible, and you are responsible for it." That was the left hook. The right hook was, you know, "I'm not sure I want to continue dating you if this is the real you. This person is like a monster." There was like a cataract over my eyes. I was not seeing this most obvious thing, that she coming down fresh in 10 minutes looks at this and says it's terrible.
Well, you talk about cognitive dissonance. I think that's a very interesting point, when people's personal values or morality really is at odds with their behavior.
Yeah, it's a very common phenomenon that's been widely studied by psychologists, I know, in Australia as well as in the United States. You know, when your behavior does not mesh with your values and attitudes, typically what happens is your attitudes and values change to fit the behavior rather than the other way around. Talmudic scholars would say, you know, get people to pray before you try to get them to believe. Once they start praying, they'll come to believe what they're doing. So a lot of evil done by good people is really more from the evil of inaction.
Yes, we tend to pathologize evil acts, don't we? In psychology circles, your own profession, there's a tendency to say that the people who do evil things are, it's an aberrant mind or it's an aberrant set of genes. In a sense, this really democratized evil, this work.
Oh, yeah. I let everybody in on it. The problem that I, as a social psychologist, have is there's such a movement toward explaining everything in terms of genetics, brain process, personality traits. Our research is really a counter-reaction which says, yes, behavior is always a product of what people bring into any situation. But what we have all underestimated is how powerful and subtle situational forces can be to reshape our behavior. And this is forces in classrooms, in business, in our families. Just being aware that you have that vulnerability is the single best protection against it happening.
There were some unexpected personal gains for the students and staff who participated in that experiment.
Well, the usual formula for evaluating whether an experiment that's questionably ethical is, does the gain to society and to science outweigh the cost and pain to the participants? Well, in this experiment, people suffered, and that makes it unethical. There's no question. They suffered day after day, night after night. However, there was more gain from this experiment than probably any other that I know of. For example, that young man, Doug, prisoner 8612, the first one to break down, it had such a powerful impact on him. He got a degree in clinical psychology at Berkeley. And for the past 25 years, he has been a prison psychologist in the San Francisco County Jail. My students made a film called Quiet Rage, the Stanford Prison Experiment. And what he says when my students interviewed him, he says that his whole life has been trying to raise the dignity of prisoners who are put in this abusive situation and to reduce the potential for sadism of the guards.
The Red Cross has revealed it repeatedly raised concerns about the conditions at the Abu Ghraib prison with American...
It's a desolate and severe place on the outskirts of Baghdad, Abu Ghraib prison is surrounded by razor wire, guard towers and dust. There are a few trees here. Many Iraqis want to know what happened at Abu Ghraib prison. The pictures of the alleged abuse have deepened the division.
The female soldier who's become the face of the Iraq prison abuse scandal.
Last time we saw Lindy England, she was at Abu Ghraib prison holding a leash wrapped around the neck of a naked Iraqi prisoner who was writhing on the ground.
I was instructed by persons in higher rank to stand there, hold this leash. And to us, we were doing our jobs, which meant we were doing what we were told, and the outcome was what they wanted.
Democrats are leading the calls for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation.
They come back and they look at the pictures and they'd state, well, that's a good tactic, keeping up.
Philip Zimbardo, let's fast forward to 2003 and to another prison, Abu Ghraib in Iraq. It struck me that in English, Abu Ghraib means house of strange fathers. And it was indeed a strange and awful house, wasn't it?
It always was. It was Saddam Hussein's torture center, an execution center. And what happened in to the Americans was they were simply not prepared for the aftermath. They were not prepared for the insurgency, for the resistance. And so they started arresting, you know, these insurgents. And they had no place to put them. So they started dumping them in Abu Ghraib. And the prisons started filling up more and more. And then it got out of hand because they started arresting whole families. They were doing sweeps of neighborhoods. In the September 2003, Tier 1A, which is where the abuses took place, and Tier 1B next to it, had about 200 prisoners. In a few months, they had 1,000. And they only had 8 guards to deal with all of those. And the guards were not regular soldiers. They were military, police, army reservists. And the media has not picked that up. And that's critical. That means they have no training at all, none, in dealing with issues in the war zone. In addition, the Tier 1A was the soft torture center. You don't use physical abuse. You use various forms of psychological interrogation.
We all remember the photos that came out of Abu Ghraib.
God.
What was your instant reaction to those? Because you, in fact, went on to represent one of the soldiers charged with atrocities. You were there as a expert witness, at least.
My book, The Lucifer Effect, would not have been written. You know, it was 35 years since the Stanford Prison Study. I had never written a book about it, but wrote articles. For me, it was over and ended. I'm doing other things. But when I saw those pictures that were flashed around the world, they were shocking. They were abominable, but they were not at all surprising because I had seen those exact images in the Stanford Prison Study. Prisoners with bags over their heads, prisoners stripped naked, prisoners forced to engage in sexually degrading activities. And so you take young soldiers, the military intelligence, CIA, all these people are now telling these soldiers, winning the war, saving the lives of your buddies outside depends on your helping to soften them up. So that was their seduction to evil. My argument is these are good young men and women pulled across that line as surely as Lindy England, you know, pulled a young Iraqi prisoner by his neck with a dog leash.
Is that excusing their behavior? Is this a case of what you call excusiology?
Oh, not at all, no. But what we're saying is we can demonstrate in my analysis of Chip Frederick. He was the staff sergeant in charge of Tier 1A.
And he's the man who he clipped the wires to that terrible image of that man with the wires hanging off his fingers and a pointed Ku Klux Klan-like hood over his face.
Yeah, it's the iconic image of torture now around the world. I mean, artists are using it. I got to know this man intimately. He was an outstanding soldier. He had 9 medals and awards. He was an excellent prison guard before that in a small prison in Pennsylvania or Virginia. A great family man. And within a month, he's doing these terrible things. And so are the others. And thinking about writing the book, and then I chose to help defend him because the Bush administration and the military obviously dealt with the leak of these pictures by saying it's a few bad apples, a few rogue soldiers. And I'm saying, let's entertain the other hypothesis that they're good soldiers, like my good guards on day one, and that they were corrupted by being put in a bad barrel. Why did the bad things happen only at night shift, Abu Ghraib? In 3 months, there was never a senior officer who ever went down to that dungeon. Why? Because it was filthy. It was rats running around. There were electricity blackouts. There was no water. There were 1,000 prisoners and many naked. The place stunk. And it was dangerous. Prisoners and guards were being killed by these mortar attacks. And so you have, on the one hand, you know, military intelligence, the CIA, telling these 8 young men and women, do whatever you have to do to prepare them for interrogation. The other hand, you have nobody higher up saying, we shall do no harm, we shall honor the Geneva Convention, we want to maintain the dignity of the American military. So the push they got was, do bad, nobody's looking, the cat's away, and we will let the mice play.
And yet the prosecutor, Major Michael Holley, just did not buy your argument or evidence for what we now know as situational social dynamics, your analysis of the system or the situation influencing the soldiers' behavior.
Chip Frederick admitted guilt. There's no question he was guilty. I was simply saying that when we sentence somebody to prison, we have to take into account what were the surrounding situational and systemic forces that made a really good guy do really bad things. You no longer can focus only on individual freedom of will, individual rationality. People are always behaving in a context, in a situation. And those situations are always created and maintained by powerful systems, political systems, cultural, religious ones. And so we have to take a more complex view of human nature because human beings are complex.
Philip Zimbardo, Hannah Arendt, of course, wrote about the banality of evil, the everyday actors, as she was writing about the horrors of the Holocaust and its perpetrators. You, on the other hand, are now talking about the banality of heroism.
Well, you said earlier I was democratizing evil. I'm also democratizing heroism. That Hannah Arendt, in her brilliant analysis of Adolf Eichmann, who was the Nazi henchman responsible for the deaths of millions of Jews at Auschwitz, said that before he went to Auschwitz, he was normal. When they see him on trial at Nuremberg, normal, absolutely normal. She said what's terrible is he's terrifyingly normal. It was the situation at Auschwitz that transformed this good guy into this monster. But I'm saying, you know, the same is true about heroes. Heroes are ordinary people who do extraordinary deeds. We point to Nelson Mandela and Mother Teresa, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, people who have organized their whole life around sacrifice. They are the rare exception. Most heroes are heroes of the moment. These are people like the guy who exposed the Abu Ghraib abuses is a guy named Joe Darby, the most ordinary person in the world.
Who's now living under a constant security.
Well, he and his wife and mother had to be put in protective custody because everybody wanted to kill him. Instead of being a hero, he was the enemy of the people because he made apparent to the world the terrible things that soldiers were allowed to do. So I end the book with a call for encouraging, fostering the heroic imagination in our children as the best antidote to evil. So to be a hero doesn't involve, as far as my analysis, special attributes. It's not you're more conscientious, you're more altruistic, you're more unselfish. You are an ordinary person who, in a particular situation, a particular time in your life, sees the world the way it really is, as Christina Maslach saw at the Stanford Prison Study, where 50 other people who came down didn't see what she saw. And what I want to argue is all of us have the potential for evil, but more importantly, all of us have the potential to be heroes.
Philip Zimbardo, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the program this week. Thank you very much for joining me as a guest.
Natasha, I loved the program. Thank you.
And Philip Zimbardo is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and former President of the American Psychological Society. His new book, The Lucifer Effect, Why Good People Turn Evil, is published by Random House. And I've linked to his websites for more on the prison experiment and the Lucifer Effect. Some excellent reading there, especially his tips on how to resist influences and avoid crossing that line between good and truly awful. You can catch the downloadable podcast and streaming audio of the show, and later in the week a transcript at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And my thanks today to studio engineer Alex Stinson. I'm Natasha Mitchell. with more grist to your mental mill next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.